You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. This week, we're trying to break bad habits. I don't mean habits like biting your fingernails or picking your nose when no one's watching. I mean the kind of habits that take over your life. First up, Toby makes a life-changing investment.
It was New Year's Eve in 2017. I was sitting on the seventh story of the Google headquarters in Pyrmont in Sydney with my partner Tom and his best friends. We had a clear view of the fireworks that had been launched over the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It was spectacular, and I felt very, very lucky. But I was distracted, as Tom explains.
We travelled up to Sydney to watch the fireworks, from the Google offices there where my best friend works, so we had access to it. So that was pretty special, having access to that view. And I guess I'd hoped that you'd be part of the party, but you were having your own party. And I guess it was a little frustrating.
What did that party consist of?
Checking your phone.
And what was I checking on my phone?
You were checking to see how much your Bitcoin was worth.
But do you understand why I was doing that?
Well, just in case you'd become a millionaire in the last 5 seconds.
Isn't that a good... That sounds like a great reason to check your phone, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can apply that logic ad nauseum until suddenly you are literally doing nothing with your life other than checking your phone.
At that point, I had 10 different iPhone applications and 15 different accounts that managed over 30 different cryptocurrencies. I owned Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero, Zcash, Dcash, Bitcoin Cash, XRP, Stellar, Tron, Cardano, IOTA, and Dogecoin. Yes, Dogecoin. The cryptocurrency whose one and only selling point was that its logo was a picture of a Shiba Inu dog. That's it. Dogecoin presently has a market cap of $224 million American dollars, or by the time you listen to this, possibly absolutely nothing. Welcome to crypto. I first got into Bitcoin in 2013 out of pure luck. A good friend drunkenly told me about it, and I soberly bought it. And then I did an incredibly brilliant thing. I completely forgot about it, which is a wonderful investment strategy. Not just for cryptocurrencies. Doesn't matter what you're investing in. Forgetting you have an investment is a great way to let that investment accrue a lot of value. Wind the clock forward to 2017, the value of Bitcoin skyrocketed to, at its peak, 22,000 Australian dollars per coin. And all the media coverage about Bitcoin shook something loose in my head. I remembered I'd bought in at what had turned out to be an incredibly fortuitous time. The value of my investment had increased 20-fold. I was like a baby boomer who bought a house in the 70s and made it big, except I know how to use a mobile. Too well, in fact. In rediscovering my brilliant investment, I attempted to reenact that brilliance all over again and again and again. Maybe I wasn't just lucky. Maybe I was, in fact, a genius investor. I put in small amounts, then increasingly greater ones. And I wasn't just buying crypto. I was betting on the crypto futures markets. That's where you bet money that the price of a currency will either rise or fall. It's a quick way to make a buck, or, if you're wrong, lose your pants. My biggest investment was 5,000 American dollars, which quickly became 6,000 American dollars before becoming 4,000 American dollars, all in the span of an hour. Now, of course, when I first began surfing the Bitcoin wave, it felt pretty good. But while I was wandering around graciously explaining how the blockchain worked to anyone who'd listen, I was fortunate to have a very good financial advisor on hand, Mum.
So I guess there's just a lot of hot air and flim flam and the gully gully man about gambling. And so I don't like gambling. I've always had to work for money, and so I treat it with a moderate amount of respect. Nate.
Far from viewing crypto as a serious investment, she saw what I was doing as gambling, and she didn't like it one bit.
It's gambling, and gambling I think is not a good idea unless you've got money to burn. And
well, even if you've got money to burn it, sir.
If you like the thrill, if you're the sort of person that needs to give yourself a thrill because you think you're going to either win big or lose big, and you like to be the centre of attention if you're a high roller, then that's fine. But
I do. Do you reckon I like to be the centre of attention?
Well, I would hope you're not being with your Bitcoin. What are you doing running around the streets with a sign around your neck shouting, I'm a Bitcoin idiot?
And at that stage in 2017, I definitely was that Bitcoin idiot. And having worked as a stand-up comedian for 10 years, I don't mind being an idiot. But money and finance and currency trading hadn't really featured that high on my list of priorities. No one goes into comedy because of their passion for finance. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I was one of those kids who was a bit of a business whiz, and I'd just forgotten about it. So I checked with Mum. When I was a little boy, would you say I showed business acumen?
No, there was no lemonade stand outside or anything like that. You liked to buy things. I can't really remember a lot of your expenditure patterns. I can remember once you invested in an extremely vulgar little bottle opener that was a naked body with a couple of faux rubies on it. But I thought it was gold. You did.
I bought it at the Jamieson Market you in Canberra and I thought it was made of gold.
You did, and I've still got it at home because you loved it and I loved you, and so now I have to love that little little bottle opener. So it's still there.
So it turns out I didn't really have a history of finance. And when I began writing this piece, it struck me. Where did this interest come from? Maybe it was just the highs you get when you're gambling and winning lots of money. But I never really liked gambling before either. And that's what my interest in crypto had become. So to try to understand where my somewhat inexplicable, intense interest in crypto had come from, I began to read over my diary. And I discovered that the period when I'd gotten into crypto overlapped perfectly with the marriage equality postal vote. Tom and I campaigned hard for the Yes vote. We ran fundraisers for the Yes campaign, a comedy night at the Athenaeum. We wrote and filmed two advertisements that got shared tens of thousands of times on social media, wrote print pieces. We lived it, and it took going back over my diary to realise just how horrible it was to live it. I found a section where I wrote about how I was feeling after I found out the postal vote was definitely happening. So it's official. We have to convince the whole country that we're human. We have to be polite and careful with how we describe ourselves and our relationships, and the other side gets to say pretty well whatever they want. We're a danger to children. We're Nazis. We're like people who have sex with animals. We're destroying religious freedom, families, and the whole fabric of society. It feels like a national trial with the whole of Australia as the jury. And there was nowhere to escape that trial. It was on the radio, it was on TV, it was in every newspaper, it was all over social media. And of course, it was there when we came home. Because we were the debate. Our relationship was the debate. What would we do if we lost? I mean, we'd still love each other, of course. But what would we do if our home country said no? No one knew at that point, but Tom and I had gotten engaged a year before. And here we were having to earn the right to follow through in our engagement with what felt like a pound of flesh. And Bitcoin and blockchain and cryptocurrencies gave me a distraction from what the Australian Christian lobby had said that day, or what the polls were saying. And it helped me find a form of self-worth, a literal form of worth. I could put a figure on it. I could wake up and say, I am worth 8 Bitcoin today, and that is worth X amount. And that mattered. It mattered while our worth was being debated on a national scale. Sure, there was a chance of being hacked and losing all my money, or of an investment turning out to be a scam, but that really seemed inconsequential compared to the postal vote. Even if some guy on the internet took my money, it's nowhere near as bad as being robbed of your dignity and your humanity by your own country. But then we won the postal vote. And 2 months later, after New Year's Eve, when Tom and I talked about crypto, I realised I didn't need it anymore. I didn't need to escape daily life anymore. So I sold out of most of my crypto, deleted the apps and stopped following crypto news. And when, in early March of this year, Tom and I got married, when we stood in front of 150 friends and family in Edinburgh Gardens in Melbourne, and our greyhound banjo was our ring bearer, when our couple name, Toto, became official, it felt wonderful. It felt like a sort of healing. For a lot of people, addressing the underlying causes that drive addictive behaviour isn't an easy fix.
I was lucky because my problem, feeling like my community was the target of hatred and fighting against that hatred, got settled with a vote. Of course, homophobia still exists, but the sense of being on trial ended. I'm lucky that once our national debate over the value of my relationship was over, the idea of spending time crouched over my mobile, checking the value of Dogecoin in Korea, seemed crazy, even to me. I got to marry the love of my life in front of my friends and family, and that was worth more than all the crypto or real money in the world. So I guess I really am lucky.
That story was by Toby Halligan. Ivana Ho was the supervising producer. Additional thanks to Andrew McClellan and Mikey Stratford Hutch. All the Best is a show where emerging Australian storytellers learn how to make audio stories. If you want to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us from anywhere in Australia. We also have a team of wonderful supervising producers to help you. Email contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Up next, Victor finds relief while spending time in a cell. This story contains reference to drug use, self-harm, and suicide.
Victor was standing at the entrance to a hallway lined with doors. Each door had a number written on it. He looked down at the note in his hand.
And there was this little note. He said, you know, your cell number is this and you're free to go to your cell at these times and be in the hall at these other times.
He found his cell number, walked in and closed the door behind him.
It is no more than 2.5 meters long and it is less than 2 meters wide. If I stand in the cell and extend my arms on either side of me, I can touch the walls, brick walls. So it's very, very quiet. You don't hear anything. Only the sound of your own breathing, that's it.
This is Victor describing the first time he sat in a meditation cell on a 10-day Vipassana course. It wasn't the first time he'd spent time in a cell.
And it was absolutely dark. I lasted, I think, maybe 15 minutes. And that was it. No more cell for me. I came out. I was withdrawing from heroin, and I needed money. I was driving around thinking about how I could get some money. In the back of the car was a bread knife and one of my girlfriend's skirts. So I cut the bottom off the skirt off and tied it at the top so it fitted over my head. And that was my mask, and with a bread knife, I held up the grocery store. Then I got $300, and I got 1 gram of heroin. That girl's face just never goes out of my mind. Her fear, her disbelief, all of that. The next day, I'd run out of the heroin. I'd already committed one armed robbery, so I committed another one. Then the second time, I was actually caught in the process. There was a security guard there. He called the police. I was caught and I was locked up and I wasn't going to get bail. So I was put in a cell and I was withdrawing from heroin.
Before Victor had started using heroin, he'd been working as a drug and alcohol counsellor for 9 years.
And my last position was the coordinator of a 12-bed residential treatment unit for short to medium-term drug addicts and alcoholics.
It was actually through this job that Victor had got into using heroin.
I met a girl while I was there. My marriage was pretty much going onto the rocks. And I got caught up in what therapists classically call counter-transference.
Basically, Victor became romantically involved with his client. He was treating her for heroin addiction.
So I'd quit my marriage, and then I started using heroin.
Within a week of being in prison, Victor ran into a former client.
He looks at me, he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Guess what?" He said, "No." And I said, "Yes." And then he said, "You always were a bit of an asshole, weren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I was." I was beyond embarrassment,
yeah,
Ryan.
This
it was
something
just
that you were supposed to be treating people for, and
well, yes, it was. I went to the psychologist. I asked for an appointment with the jail psychologist, and I went to him and I said, "Listen, you know, I was a drug and alcohol counselor, and this is where I am now." And look, I was feeling very sorry for myself, and I was in tears. After listening to me for a while, he says, "Listen, mate, I've got rapists, murderers, psychopaths, sociopaths to deal with, and you're in here whining and crying about the fact that you're a heroin addict and you're withdrawing from heroin." And he says, "I haven't got time. Just go away." So I said, "All right." The biggest difficulty when you stop using heroin is the depression that comes. For about 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 3 months, there is constant depression, just a constant darkness. That darkness can be suicidal. It can be... And I was looking for ways to do it, and mostly feeling really sorry for myself. And so I thought, okay, I've just got to find something to do. So I went down to the library and I came across a book by D.T. Suzuki called The Three Pillars of Zen. So I read this and I thought, you got nothing to lose. So I sat and I started observing my breathing, observing the breath coming in and the breath going out. I'd do it for 15 seconds and stop.
What was going on?
I just couldn't stay there. Like, it was just impossible. Within 15 seconds, it was all thoughts just kept crashing in on me all the time. And, you know, you're in jail and you're withdrawing from drugs and, you know, you're a dickhead and you're an idiot. You know, I had a young child. My son was 18 months old.
Victor was alone in his cell for 14 hours a day. He continued to spend that time sitting, trying to meditate. Then he was moved to Cessnock, a medium security prison. He was working as the prison librarian.
One day, this fellow came to me and he said, "Where are the poetry books?" And I told him where the poetry books were, and he spent 2 hours looking through all the poetry books. And then he came back, he says, "Is that all you've got?" His girlfriend was going to have a baby, and it was his baby. The poor guy was feeling absolutely miserable about the fact that he'd gone and got himself locked up, and he wanted to send her a card, and he wanted to put a poem in it, and he couldn't find one. So I said, "Look, come back tomorrow." So I went back to my cell and I wrote him a poem. He came back, he got some books, and off he went. And 2 weeks later, he comes back and he says to me, "Here are the books, page 40, mate. You want to have a look at page 40? So I look at page 40. There's a nice joint, nice marijuana joint all rolled up for me. So, you know, the proper thing to do would have been to meditate, but now I was onto something, and I became for a while, the resident poet of Cessnock Prison. They all knew that I used to be a drug and alcohol counsellor. So I would also get asked about what to say when they were going to talk to their parole officers. What's a good thing to say? What's going to convince them to let me get out of there? And this was my route. This was my little angle.
After he got out, Victor continued using heroin. He served a second prison sentence. After his second sentence, he was arrested and charged again, this time for break and enter. Victor was facing a maximum sentence of 15 years.
The first thing I did was try and create this big illusion as to why I couldn't go to court. I cut into myself with a knife and took myself to hospital. I was full of drugs at the time as well, and said, "Somebody's done this to me." The doctors in hospital told me I missed my internal organs by 2 millimeters.
His plan worked. Victor avoided court, and he was on the run from the police. It's hard to imagine this ending well. How long before Victor commits another burglary, gets caught again? How long before he overdoses, or worse? Against all odds, none of those things happen.
But while I was on the operating table, I had an epiphany. Something happened. I heard a voice inside of me saying, "If you think you're suffering now, think how much I suffered for love of you." I was convinced that this was some divine intervention. And from that day on, I didn't stop using drugs because I was very heavily addicted to methadone at the time. But my life slowly started to turn around.
Victor started going to church. At church, he met a monk who invited Victor to stay with him at a hermitage.
Which is like a mini monastery where there's only two monks.
Victor would go on retreats to the hermitage to meditate and pray.
While I was up there, I came down cold turkey from the methadone. Took about, it was hell. But anyway, it was gone.
Then Victor gave himself up to the police. He'd been on the run for 3 years, but he hadn't gone to trouble with the police and he hadn't been using heroin. So the judge was lenient. He was given 400 hours of community service. He continued to go to the hermitage to do his retreats, but then it got sold.
And I thought, where am I going to go? Where am I going to go for my retreat?
Then he found the Vipassana Center.
I read the Code of Discipline, which was 10 days of silence, and I thought, this is waiting for me. So I sat my first course. It was very, very, very difficult. But at the same time as being extremely difficult, there was a real sense of gratitude, like I've been fortunate enough to find what I've been looking for, because at one level, this Victor that didn't want to know that there was another dimension to him, a spiritual dimension perhaps, was really tugging and pulling. But at another level, I don't know how to describe it, was there was a sense of you've come home.
The cell used to be a form of punishment for Victor. It was something he was running away from. Victor now lives and works at the Vipassana Center. And there, the cell is a place for meditation.
The most curious thing is that there is no greater sense of freedom that I feel than when I'm actually in silence in the cell. And I still think sometimes of the pillow and the meter-thick sandstone walls of Long Bay Prison, looking there, sitting in the cell, and the way I felt then and the way I feel now. And to me, it is such, I don't know if it's irony, anomaly, what it is, that, you know, I came to meditation as a prisoner, and now I actually get up and with a great sense of gratitude go to my cell, and every time I sit there, I learn more and more to be free.
That story was by Ryan Pemberton, and the supervising producer was Alison Chan. If you'd like to talk to someone about anything that was brought up in this story, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Ryan Pemberton. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.